Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. It's time for Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. I have an interesting lineup of guests. Marie Drake Planetarium is doing a show tonight called Bad Astronomy, and we will hear about that in a few minutes. Susan Jabal and others will be here from the Juno Family Health and Birth Center talking about some changes that they're putting in. Our sustainability segment today is with Darren Snyder, the cooperative extension agent, talking about composting in his office. And Principal Sarah Marino of the Kuskanihiti High School will be here to talk to us about comings on at Juno High School. So we woke up this morning and looked at the ground, and it was all white. It's going to keep doing that, according to the Weather Bureau, through Thursday. And then Friday, it'll probably just turn to rain Friday night.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native people are assessing damage after Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast Monday. Kathleen Ash Mildy Navajo lives in Maplewood, New Jersey, outside of Newark. Her area faced high winds and lost a number of trees. Power is out, and part of her roof is damaged.
They're going to prioritize the hospitals and places like that, and in residential areas like ours are going to be pretty low on the list. So we're just going to have to suffer through it and try to figure out how to make it. I think many of us bought a lot of food before this all happened, but I don't think anyone expected that we would have to be living without refrigeration or stoves working for over a week.
Lights are also out in Richfield, Connecticut, where Star Hardridge is held up with his family. He's a Muscogee Creek living in Redding, but stayed with family in Richfield overnight. After dealing with a blizzard last year, which knocked out electricity, he prepared for Sandy by gathering supplies.
They were having a mad rush at the grocery stores and at the gas stations. A lot of the people running generators up here off of gas, so there were actually some stations that sold out of gas.
And in Providence, Rhode Island, James Fulton fared well. He says many people prepared for the storm.
Rhode Island is fine, like I said, besides southern Rhode Island. Every northern, eastern Rhode Island is pretty much fine. No damage or heavy damage done.
Fulton lives about 35 minutes from his tribe, the Narragansett Indian tribe.
I haven't heard from anyone yet, but I do know that the tribal council is safe. Nothing happened to the tribal council over westerly Rhode Island, as far as I'm concerned. But everything else is fine as far as I know.
Native people in New York are also assessing damage. The United South and Eastern Tribes, or USET, is working with tribes impacted by Sandy. USET says the Shinnecock Indian Nation, Mohegan Tribe of Indians, and Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation declared states of emergency. Tribes in Sandy's path are coordinating with federal agencies on recovery efforts. More than 3 months after suspected arson burned six spiritual and cultural sites on the Lac-Courtier Reservation in Sawyer County, Wisconsin, no charges have been filed, no person arrested, and no comment from law enforcement agencies. As Mike Simonson reports, at least one tribal official says answers are overdue.
Sweat lodges, a ceremonial drum circle and drum lodge, and part of the Out of the Earth powwow ground were all torched the 14th and 15th of July. That included Alvin Baker's Purification Lodge, which burned to the ground. Now Baker says it's time for him and tribal officials to speak out. Even as a victim, Baker says law enforcement is leaving him in the dark.
We don't have any information about where it's going. I can't get any information. Nobody will talk to me about it.
LCO Tribal Governing Board Member Mick Isham says most people on the reservation share Baker's frustration.
We don't understand why it's taken so long. It seems like in any other case, boom, they're in jail, they're charged.
In fact, LCO Attorney James Schlender Jr. says emails have been sent to the Sawyer County District Attorney's Office. The reply: no decision has been made on charges relating to the arson cases. Schlender says they're asking for an inquiry about that. Isham says although he believes the danger is past, he says this was a hate crime.
Total hate crime and religious. I mean, the community came together. The parents apologized to the community. That's how sure he was of it. I don't know what more can be done, really.
We have received no comments from District Attorney Bruce Poquette, the Sawyer County Sheriff's Department, the State Department of Justice, and Fire Marshal's Office. The U.S. Attorney is not available, and the FBI will only say that they are aware of the investigation. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
During this month in 1988, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed by Congress. It established federal regulations for gaming and protects gaming as a means of generating tribal revenue. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hey, we're in the middle of Pledge Week here at KTOO, so just wanted to remind you real quickly that there are people standing by on our telephones, and the telephone numbers to call are 586-3636 or 1-800-478-3636 if you're out of our calling area. And you can also pledge online. There's a nice form out there that's really easy to indicate your pledge on. Just go to www.ktoo.org and click on the link that says membership. So, John Kramers is here, and he's talking about a show that he's going to deliver tonight at Marie Drake Planetarium called Bad Astronomy. John, the title requires some minimal explanation, at least.
Well, I thought about doing this for a while, and the bad astronomy is the idea that there's a lot of misconceptions about astronomy. Some of them are, I would categorize as just, you know, kind of errors in facts. And some of them are, you know, to a much higher level. Like I would categorize the hoax that the lunar landing didn't really happen is in that later category. So those are the kind of things. You know, some of them are myths. One that I was going to talk tonight about is you can stand an egg on its end during the spring equinox. So, you know, where did that start from, and why is it true or not true, and some other ones that you know, I'll talk to, and some of them it's in language. You know, we use you'll see statements like "this is light years ahead," as comparing light year to a measurement of time where it's not; it's really a measurement of distance. So things like that. So it should be an interesting show. I hope it'll be somewhat educational. And we'll show the night sky as we normally do. So tonight you wouldn't be able to see the stars from Juno because it's going to be cloudy and snowing right now. But at the planetarium, you'll be able to see what the stars would be if you could go out and look at them.
So one of the things that every fictional science fiction writer has to deal with is the fact that with anything less than some kind of way to break the speed of light, it's going to take like 4 years minimum to get to Alpha Centauri. And a lot longer to get to the stars that are fun to write into the story. So are you going to deal with that any tonight?
Right. I wasn't going to address too much the movie end of it, or science fiction end, where, you know, it's kind of questionable science that you could accomplish some of the things that we see in the movies. But there are some things that are interesting in movies, and one of that are, you know, you could put in the category of bad astronomy, and one of them would be you see a starship go by, and they'll usually make a really loud noise as the starship goes by, and in outer space you wouldn't have any sound like that. It would just be very silent as the starship went by. So there's things like that that are interesting. Some people go to an extreme with they'll analyze movies. And they'll you know, for whatever things they're looking at, and they'll just come up with really nitpicky things. I don't want to dwell too much on that. You know, it is what it is when you make a movie and you're trying to for effect. And so I'm going to stay away from that a little bit. I'm also going to stay away from as much as possible religious implications on some of the things. I don't really want to go there. It's just there's some things that are beliefs. You know, and that's fine. That's not really bad science or good science. That's a belief system. And then there's things that are people have misconception about facts. That's a different thing. That's what I was going to more talk about.
So, are there is there any truth to the fact that, or the idea that a lot of the ancient structures on the Earth were aligned to stars because they were astronomical observatories?
Right. I think, you know, I'm not sure that they know exactly, but there are, you know, people have different opinions. And that they're aligned by the stars and the sun. Yeah, it's most likely that they used the sun. You know, on certain days of the year, the shadow of the sun would go in a certain direction, and that's not inconceivable that happened. And what gets to me to be a bit of a stretch is when they take it to another level and they start talking about aliens. So aliens came to the Earth and they showed them how to do this, and that's where it comes a stretch to me.
Trying to think of the name of the guy that probably 20 years ago, there was some guy who did a TV special, and they went down and they shot the large rock paintings in Nazca, I think it is, and supposedly said that, you know, if you got from outer space, then these would be like landing lights and that sort of thing.
Right, and that's where, you know, it becomes a bit of a stretch for me. Space travel is a bit, you know, dubious at best. We've been around for quite a while, and we got the best we've been able to do is send a person to the moon, which is nowhere near going to another planet, let alone out of our solar system. So it's just it's not really conceivable to me that aliens would fly by the Earth or land. Number one, if they were that, if you could travel like that, why would they come all the way here? Why wouldn't they, you know, explore in their own neighborhood, most likely? So it's, you know, it's kind of a dubious question to me. But
it could be that big sign out by Jupiter that says, heat here, get gas.
That could be.
So we do actually have a probe, though, that's out, as I understand it, right at the fringes of space, solar space?
I think it's called the Oort cloud. Basically, yeah. That's a cloud of gases that's in our solar system. It sort of marks the outer boundaries. And there were the two early explorers.
Voyager 1 and Voyager 2.
Voyager
1
and Voyager 2 that were sent out. And they're both really close to that, if not past that that edge. It's amazing that, you know, that it's been that while, but look how long it's taken to send that out there. Mm-hmm. That Voyagers were sent up in the early 60s, and they're just barely making it to the edge of our solar.
Yep.
Our
one of them is carrying a record that's got a recording on it by someone no one remembers.
You know? Yeah. I hope it was a good record.
Anyway. And probably two languages that have no longer any speakers on the planet as we lose people who speak these languages. Well, this sounds like an interesting show. Bad astronomy. I was thinking while you were talking, you could probably do another show on good astronomy.
Well,
there's got to be somebody like Kubrick, for sure. I mean, caught it in 2001. I think at least the mission, and particularly the interstellar, or not the interstellar, but the landing on the space station between the Earth and the moon, and then the trip on out to the moon. I think he caught a great deal of reality into that piece.
Yeah, that was,
of course, he was working with Art Clark, which would not let him mess it up too bad, because Clark was half a scientist himself.
Right, that would be an interesting show. Maybe we could look at doing that. Yeah, if we made one, some good examples of astronomy in movies would make be a good show to do, and we could do a little movie clips, and it might be a fun topic.
Hey, count me in. I'll sit down with you. I think I got some ideas for it. Okay, John Kramer's tonight, 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium. Take a look at what the night sky is looking like up above all those clouds and that falling snow that we're going to enjoy until sometime Thursday night, at which point then Friday it starts raining on top of it. That should make for some interesting driving conditions on Friday if it stays cold. Anyway, 6:30 to 7:30, tonight's presentation is on bad astronomy. John Kramer's is the star of the show. Come on down to the planetarium and take it in.
Thanks a lot. And remember to pledge. And if you pledge at the radio station, the show is free.
Yeah, there you go. The numbers are 586-3636, 1-800-478-3636, or pledge online at www.ktoo.org.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. The raven, its voice is unmistakable, held a prominent place in the myths of many cultures, from the Vikings to the tribes of the Northwest coast, across the entire Northern Hemisphere. Today, ravens are the fascinating subjects of scientific study. Raven researcher Bernd Heinrich writes, "Ravens associate with any animals that kill large game. Polar bears, grizzlies, wolves, coyotes, killer whales, and humans. In the Arctic, native peoples know when the caribou arrive on their migrations by the announcements of ravens who travel with them and feed on the kills of the wolves along the flanks of the herds." Ravens quickly took advantage of the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone National Park in the 1990s, joining them to scavenge at kills. Curiously, ravens seemed to avoid animal carcasses when wolves were absent. One explanation is that the raven's bill can't cut into a carcass. A large carnivore must tear through the tough hide first. Some believe the bond between ravens and wolves runs deeper. Perhaps ravens even help lead wolves to their prey. Learn more about ravens at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
It's 17 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. My next guests are here from the Juneau Family and Health and Birth Center. Susan Jabal is the executive director, and Emily Kane, Dr. Emily Kane, is with her. Hi. I hear things are changing at the birth center. What's changing?
It's all good. The birth center has decided to refocus on its primary strength, which is to deliver healthy babies and provide continuum for care for healthy families.
And so how will this change take place? And what are we changing from?
Well, we've been an organization that's done a couple of different things for a while, and including we have a family health clinic with a physician on staff, and that has been a remarkable, honorable experience, and we've enjoyed it fully. But we found that it sort of pulled us into two different directions, and has led to a place where we have two separate client bases. And we are interested in integrating everything together and really focusing all of our strength and energy into one direction, which is in providing wraparound services using the midwifery model of care.
How does that differ from hospital birth?
The midwifery model of care is more based on a non-medical model. It's focused on healthy pregnancy and healthy childbirth and healthy babies and healthy families. So it's not based on how do I describe it?
Well, I think that intervention would happen as needed with a healthy pregnancy model, as opposed to assuming that interventive inquiry is a part of the standard of care. So a midwifery model doesn't assume that a need for intervention, of course. The midwives are well trained to switch into or refer to that type of care, but the objective is to have a non-medical approach, that childbirth is something that women have been doing naturally for thousands and thousands of years, and it doesn't have to be a hospital-based event. So we're all about providing that option for women, is to have natural childbirth experiences.
Maybe some of my experience bears here. My wife and I got pregnant when she was turning 40. And we were in Oregon at the time, and we had a terrible time finding a physician who didn't consider this to be a panic situation. Dolores is an extremely healthy woman. She did yoga up until the night before we took her to the hospital. And we had a really rough battle in the Portland metropolitan area finding a physician who was willing to accept the fact that we were going to have a reasonably normal birth here, because there was something in the medical profession that said that at her age, this was going to be a panic. Does that bear on what you're doing here?
I can answer a little bit, because, Pat, I'll share that I was 42 when I had my first and only child, and it was under the auspices of the birth center that I had a delightful home birth. I didn't leave the house for the first week. I had a completely healthy, thriving baby, and I really enjoyed being able to be at home for my birth. And there were members of my family, including my mom, who were nervous about being 42, and because supposedly after 35 you become a high-risk mom. So as I am a naturopathic doctor, and I have a different standard of care, for example, than a medical, an MD doctor, and a midwife will have a different standard of care than an obstetrician. So, for example, when I don't have a standard of care where a certain health issue presents that I have to treat it with a drug, whereas, and so midwives don't have a standard of care where the minute someone has, gains more weight or less weight or has a little bit of sugar in their urine or whatever. I mean, this is something that the midwives can triage without going into a medical mode. Of course, there's thresholds for any kind of dangerous situation, but the vast majority of births are natural phenomenon that don't require medical intervention. So the birth center is very much about making sure that that option remains viable for women. And many women want that for themselves, and they should have that option. I'm sorry your wife didn't have that option, although she would today in Portland.
Mm.
And I want to add to that that I think a big part of the care that we provide also is in empowering the woman and the family. So, yes, we provide midwifery model of care, but we also empower a family to make that choice for themselves. If someone comes in to see us and that they're not comfortable with that care, then we can help them find the care that they are comfortable with. We do support many families through births that they choose to have with a family practice doctor at the hospital as well. And there is a very important role for the hospital in our community, and our hospital does an excellent, fantastic job. And we just want to be a place where people can go and know that they will be supported in any choices that they make regarding childbirth.
In the 21st century, one of the big considerations for any kind of medical situation is always the insurance question.
Mm-hmm.
How is insurance impacted by using the birth center?
We accept all forms of insurance. We also can assist families to get hooked into the Denali Kid Care system, and we accept Denali Kid Care. We also have a program of donated health care. There are lots of instances where people will slip through the cracks through insurance, through Denali Kid Care, all of those types of programs. There might be special circumstances within their family that they do not qualify or allow for any of those. So in that case, the donated health care program that we have at the birth center would kick into place. No one is ever turned away from care from us for inability to pay. They will always be accepted into our services.
If a woman were using the birth center under normal circumstances, would she give birth at the birth center?
She can choose to give birth at the birth center. We also do provide support for home birth, as Emily has said. And we cannot assist with birth at the hospital, but we can support a woman. We have a lot of women who come in and have all of their prenatal care at our facility, but then they do choose to give birth at the hospital.
That was going to be my question. My next question was, to what extent does the birthing center support someone who, for one reason or another, has opted to work with a family physician at the hospital?
Yep, we can go ahead and provide all the prenatal care, and then we can also come in and have postpartum care. And we offer doula support services as well. And a doula is not a healthcare provider, but they can be an advocate. They're an expert in all elements of birth and postpartum and prenatal, so they can come in and support a woman who is having a hospital birth and just be an advocate for her and help her to understand what is happening and what to expect.
You just used a term I've never heard before. What's a doula?
A doula is a birth professional. She's not a healthcare provider. She does not provide healthcare services. She just provides emotional support and social support for a family, a woman, who may need it, who may have extra stresses in her life that she needs a little assist. It's sort of like mothering the mother. Like birthing care throughout history has always been, passed down. Mothers, sisters have attended births. and gone on like that through generations. And now in this day and age, that's a little bit more, as people move away from their extended families, it's a little more difficult to come by, and that's where a doula can be a really valuable tool.
If someone is, go ahead.
I wanted to mention that in that the birth center is very committed to provide a continuum of care. I think it's also important that the community know that whether or not a woman or a family chooses to actually have their birth experience with the birth center, they can get lactation service advice there. They can get parenting lessons. They can get pre- and postnatal nutritional counseling. They can get prenatal yoga. There's a wide spectrum of services around a healthy birth, whether or not the client chooses to actually deliver through the birth center. So I think that's important that the community recognizes that there's a real resource for them there.
So to close this out, the change that's coming to the birthing center then is to move away from a practice model and to focus in almost entirely on births. Is that, do I have that right?
Yes, on supporting families through the birth continuum. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is taking effect like right now.
Yes.
So if someone is interested in taking advantage of these services, how do they get in touch with you?
They can call us at any time. We do free consultations for pregnant families, and our phone number is 586-1203. Or they can check us out online as well. Our website is www.junobirthcenter.org.
Thank you very much. I think it sounds like you're very well committed to a small change of direction, but it sounds like it's going to be a very successful operation. So I wish you good luck with it. And we'll close with a little appropriate music.
Thank you.
Well, our music is evidently not going to cooperate, so it's time for Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 30th, 2012. It's the birthday of Fred W. Friendly, born Ferdinand Friendly Wackenheimer in New York City, 1915, went to work for CBS Radio, and there met Edward R. Murrow, whose producer Friendly became. They did a number of news documentaries together for CBS News, where Fred W. Friendly resigned in protest in 1966 when CBS scrapped a hearing on Vietnam so they could run a rerun of I Love Lucy. It's the birthday of Ezra Pound, born in Haley, Idaho, 1885, whose reputation is based in part on his great generosity in promoting the work of other writers, James Joyce and William Carlos Williams, D.H. Lawrence, Marianne Moore, and T.S. Eliot. Ezra Pound, in his early 20s, taught literature at a small college in the Midwest, but he caused a scandal by allowing a stranded vaudeville actress to sleep over at his place. He was fired for that, but the college gave him the rest of his year's salary, and he headed off to Europe with it. He wanted to meet William Butler Yeats, who he thought was the greatest poet writing in English. He found Yeats, befriended him, worked as his secretary, and later married the daughter of Yeats's former lover. In 1914, Ezra Pound met T.S. Eliot, and he campaigned to get the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock published in Poetry Magazine. Ezra Pound, who spent most of his writing life on the Cantos, a modern epic. There are 109 completed cantos. The first begins, and then went down to the ship, set keel to breakers, forth on the godly sea. And we set up mast and sail on that swart ship, bore sheep aboard her, and our bodies also, heavy with weeping, and winds from sternward bore us out onward with bellying canvas, Circe's this craft, the trim-coiffed goddess. And it's the birthday of the second president of the United States, John Adams, Braintree, Massachusetts, 1735. Made a name for himself as a young man by arguing against the British right to tax the colonies. Became an advocate for independence from Great Britain. It was Adams who nominated George Washington to serve as commander of the Continental Army, and it was John Adams who chose Thomas Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. Here's a poem for today by C.K. Williams, entitled Rush Hour. Someone has folded a coat under the boy's head. Someone else, an Arab businessman in not very good French, is explaining to the girl who seems to have discovered like this in the crowded metro her lover is epileptic, that something must be done to keep the boy from swallowing his tongue. He works a billfold between the rigidly clenched teeth as the kneeling girl silently looks on. Her expression of just contained terror, transfiguring her, generalizing her almost to the mythic, the very image of our wonder at what can befall the most ordinary afternoon of early love. The spasms quiet, the boy, his left ear scarlet from rubbing the wool, comes to, looks up at the girl, and she, as the rest of us begin to move away, hesitates, then lays her cheek lightly on his brow. Rush Hour, poem by C.K. Williams from his collected poems, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve what potential customers find online in search engines and review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles and produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
27 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. I'd like to remind you that there is a book signing going on from 4:30 to 6 this afternoon at Nugget Mall in the Valley. Gary Gunkel will be there signing a copy of his new book, Courage and Conviction, An Alaska State Trooper's Journey Through a Life of Principled Law Enforcement. The book is available, and you can have a copy signed by the author and have a chance to visit with him by going by Hearthside Books and Toys, in the Nugget Mall in the Valley.
You can still subscribe to Perseverance Theater this season. With Pick 4 and Pick 3 options, you can see the remaining shows in the season at a significant savings over single-ticket prices, and there's no reason to worry about having to switch nights. Oklahoma is selling like gangbusters, and the best way to lock in seats is to purchase your subscription today. Oklahoma, Betrayal, the Smash Hit Comedy Seminar, and a brand new play are all available now by calling 463-TIXS or go online at perseverancetheater.org.
The music will tell you that we're talking about sustainability again here on Juneau Afternoon, and our guest today is the Cooperative Extension Service for Juneau, Darren Snyder. We're with Darren Snyder, who is the extension agent. We're in his office, and sitting about 3 feet away from his desk is a worm bin that he is composting. At the moment, he has coffee grounds on top of shredded paper. Darren, can you tell us a little bit about this device?
Yes, this is called the Worm Factory, and it's one of at least a few different types of commercially available vermicomposters. Each one of these kind of composting systems has its benefits and its drawbacks. This one seems to work pretty well. So we have a Worm Factory and also a Can of Worms as the different brands. You can also just make these things straight out of totes. We have some publications through Extension Service that teaches you how to use, how to make vermicomposting totes, and that's a real cheap way to do it. It's like about $5 or $10 compared to these things can be up to $150 for these systems. And so what we're doing here is we are providing food for worms, and they are voracious eaters. They'll eat half their weight in a day. So one way to look at that is 1 pound of worms will eat 3.5 pounds of refuse in a week. Mm-hmm. And so you can use these worms to consume your leftovers from your kitchen wastes as you chop up your various items, vegetables and fruits and those, and add them to your compost here. And it's a management process, and there are ways of doing this right and not doing it right. So you do have to have a little bit of knowledge and in order to learn how to do this properly.
Well, as with all of the compost systems that I've seen in this short series, I notice here that this one does not smell. It has a kind of an earthy smell to it, but certainly nothing objectionable. Let's describe it. There's basically there's a black stand that it sits on the floor, and then there's a couple of trays down in them. One of them has a valve sticking out of it. Is that for draining compost tea or something? Or
exactly. And the term tea is actually a little bit of a misnomer. In this case, this is kind of a, you can actually hear that there. This is actually a just kind of a leachate that's coming out. It's with any vegetables and tissues, when bacteria start breaking them down, they release water, and so that water's got to go somewhere. If you don't properly drain your worm bins of any type, then that water will build up and it will be a bad situation. It will become anaerobic. Yeah. It will smell
that's bad. Actually when it starts to smell really bad.
Yeah. And it drowns your worms, and they'll it's just not a good scene.
Now, you're running this indoors. How cold could this get and still keep the worms alive?
You need to stay well above freezing. The desired temperatures for these specific species of worms, Eisenia foetida, which are the red wigglers, those are the types of worms that we are using in these systems. They prefer to be over 55 degrees. Room temperature is ideal for them. Even if it's a little bit warmer, into the 80s, the warmer it is up into the 80s, the more productive they are. The faster, the more they'll eat, the faster they'll reproduce, and so therefore the more refuse that they'll consume. And so the way that we work this system usually is to have this tap at the bottom open, so it doesn't actually pool up at all, and then it's just a continuous catchment, and it won't smell in that case. In this case, I did leave that the valve closed accidentally, and so that's why that. And so some of those drippings just sat there and sat there without draining for a while, so they smell a little bit. But this material that leaches out is very good for plants. You just can pour that straight into your house plants, and again, without any concern for smell, and it's good nutritive product. Now, when you mentioned tea. The term tea, and when we're referring to compost, whether it be a vermicompost, and so that's worm compost, or just other types of compost teas, or even manure teas, these are, with gardeners, these are a popular item, and they are distinctly different from what we have here, but because you are adding your compost to water, in the case of making a tea, and you can let it sit there, or you can actually bubble oxygen into it and have it be an aerated environment, and each of these different activities create kind of a different product. So that's a tea, and that's a specialized product. It's different than just a simple compost leachate that's coming out of the bottom of your compost. Mm.
The shredded paper is of interest to me. I remember from the Cornell website that you want to maintain a 30-to-1 ratio of carbon to nitrogen. Do I have that right?
Yep.
Okay, and so what's the carbon source here? Is that the paper?
Yep, that's the paper primarily. Each one of your living tissues, as it were, when you're dealing with compost and these things that are breaking down, do have a ratio of the carbon to nitrogen, and we usually break them up with different terms. Sometimes you can call them energy units versus the bulking agents. So you have energy agents and bulking agents. Another term for that is, you know, the high nitrogen to high carbon. And then another term for that is greens to browns. And so the paper here would definitely be a brown, where you do have a very high carbon to nitrogen ratio. That would be the same as wood or sawdust, chips, or brown leaves, brown grass, cardboard. All those are your browns or your bulking agents. And in this case, in vermiculture, they play an important role that's different than other composting systems. Part of it is to provide a balanced carbon to nitrogen ratio for the system overall to create a nice compost product. But when you're thinking about these worms, we've got just material from our kitchen, which has been just plopped down in there. The bacteria and fungus just starts working on it as natural processes, and the worms are starting to eat that some of the plant material that's rotten, some of the bacteria, and they're just eating that stuff. But they can't live there. They need to go somewhere, and so the carbon sources, the shredded paper, provide a habitat for those worms to come up into and live up in there as they're kind of resting and just kind of moving around. It needs to be moist because they breathe through their skin, so the paper will sometimes just moisten from the environment, or you may just have to squirt it a little bit. So it's providing a habitat for the worms, the shredded paper is, as well as it's providing a natural carbon filter for the smells. And so as a practice with vermicomposting, you always want to have a good solid layer of shredded paper covering the top of your entire system. And so that prevents the smells from coming up. It also prevents we always will have different possibilities for having small insects with our food scraps. And when we throw those away just into the trash, we never see what happens. Well, a lot of eggs from insects hatch out of the skins of some of our products, like especially bananas will have like little eggs that will eventually hatch. And in this case, since we're leaving them here, some of those flies will hatch. But if we keep a good layer of paper on the top of the entire system, then that inhibits them from being able to crawl in and out and becoming a problem. If we get lazy and we just add stuff to the top, without covering it with the shredded paper, then that's where both the smells and the insects can start the flying insects can start escaping out.
I notice a cover that sits right tight down on the top of the layer of paper before you close the lid. And is that what is that like the covers that I saw on the Williams's outdoor composts?
Well, it
there's where to keep them dry.
Yeah, that's primarily your purpose for an outside composting environment, is to keep the water off of it. In this case, it's it just kind of keeps it a little bit sealed and as a kind of a kempt, I should say, kind of a nice looking, and it doesn't, it's not exposed to being blown or anything. Not that there's too much breeze going on inside my office.
Suzanne said that she won't put any citrus on her compost beds because they're outdoors and that attracts bears. Can you put citrus on this bed?
You can, but it's not recommended because partially because the oils within the citrus rinds don't break down very easily by the worms, and so they will probably persist for a long time in that case.
Are there other things that you should not put into a compost bin?
Generally, I'll just speak to the vermicompost here. You don't want to be adding meat products and fats and oils. Not that worms can't break that stuff down eventually, but just like with any other product, if you add it to this and the worms can't keep up, then it can get kind of rancid and overwhelm them. They won't be able to keep up with breaking it down, breaking down the materials. So some of the other things most everything else is fair game for putting into your vermicomposting bin, other than those high fatty items, meats, the citrus rinds. Those are definitely things that you want to keep out typically.
When you begin one of these, the kit that comes has the worms in it. Is that right?
It depends. You have to make sure when you're ordering it. But the worms themselves are up to $40 for a single pound of the red wigglers, and so usually a company, if they're pricing it, it'll be clear whether worms come with it or not, because they aren't free. And also, it takes a little bit of management too. And it's, some companies are leery to send stuff up to living things up to Alaska for good reason. Seasonally, there may be some conversations you want to have with your shippers to make sure that they're sending it in a way that you won't freeze your worms on the way up.
Now, Suzanne made a point of the fact that the worms in her compost bin are Alaskan worms that have been they found their homes in the compost bins that she's running. And she says then that allows them to go through the winters. These worms won't survive in our Alaskan temperatures.
Right. There are different types of worms. These worms in a vermicomposting environment are called epigeic worms. They are naturally found in forests, in only the duff and the leaf litter portion of the forest. And that's why they're consuming only organic matter here. They're not going down. They don't need to go down into the soil column at all. And that's these other types of worms, which are the type that you would find in an outdoor compost pile. Those are different worms than these, a whole different kind of classification of worms. And the worms here in Alaska, just to speak to that a little bit, they all except for maybe a single variety of earthworm, so there are some 17 or more varieties of earthworms occurring in Alaska that have been found, are all introduced to Alaska. These worms are brought in plants and on vehicles, and they're introduced species into our gardens, and they do provide a benefit to us as gardeners, but they are definitely different depending on an interior and exterior environment. There are concerns by some people that we don't know exactly how earthworms can affect our outdoor environment, including specifically these vermicomposting worms, because they have been found conclusively to change forest environments dramatically down in the lower 48, because these are the same worms that anglers use as these red wigglers, and people will do vermicomposting, but with the idea it's vermiculture, where they're intentionally raising these worms so that they can sell them as bait. And if an angler tosses their extra worms to the side as they're leaving the lake, then what has happened is that they've populated some of the forest around the fishing lakes, and they're so effective at consuming the organic matter that the leaf litter levels have dropped dramatically in those forests, exposed the surface feeder roots of the trees, and the trees have been killed because the cold weather comes in and kills the roots.
What a really dramatic story.
It's dramatic.
Well, thank you, Darren. So our conversation about sustainability ties right directly into our next two guests, so we'll go straight to them. With me in the studio are Principal Sarah Marino from Yakutsk-Dakahedi School and Debbie Chalmers, who's with the Montessori School that's also in the same building. And you've been doing quite a bit of work with this as well. You're going to be on next week's sustainability program.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we went over and taped the kids. They're running the can of worms composter down in one of the entryways to the in a little place off the street down on the back side. We did some interviews, and they'll be on next week's show. So welcome aboard. So what's going
nice
on?
Nice to be here, Pat.
What's going on at school?
Well, we thought this would be a nice opportunity to talk about the Montessori Borealis Adolescent Program. And some of the unique things we do as part of our program, especially getting ready for the Thanksgiving public market, where our students will be selling quite a bit of the jams that we've been making from local produce. We have a couple of plots out at the Juneau Community Garden out with the master gardeners out in Montana Creek. One of our plots we devote completely to rhubarb, so that's one of our crops. We have a logo called Juneau Grown, and the kids design the logo. And we spend a lot of time picking berries in the fall and hopefully before school when there's still some blueberries around, and pick a lot of rose hips. And we have some wonderful wild jams that have become quite popular at public market. And we hope everybody stops by to check out our jams and purchase them. They make lovely gifts, and they're really delicious. Some of the jams that we've been making with the rose hips, we've been making rose hip orange marmalade. So our oranges are not locally grown, but the rose hips are. The rose hips are wild, and they're a great source of vitamin C. The children students have really learned a lot about how you actually take something from the raw produce and make a good product from it and keep it really as close to being a whole food as possible, so it retains a nutritional value as well. They've had a lot of fun with it. We've had a lot of fun using figuring out how to make the rose hip pulp, and with all sorts of attachments to our KitchenAid, so there's seedless, which is nice. So it's quite a process. Every Wednesday and Thursday, we have a microeconomy class. So we're teaching small business skills. The students are learning how to run their own business and how to budget for the materials that they use to make the jams. So that's pretty much what the small business entails. We spend some time in the classroom working on the money aspect of it and the budgeting and marketing aspect of our business, and the rest of the time in the kitchen, making the jams and hoping they gel properly, and looking at the inventorying our produce and seeing how much we need and how much we think we can produce before Thanksgiving. So that's our big push this year.
It's a really amazing project to watch 7th and 8th grade students go from harvesting materials, learning how to create something out of it, and then into the business aspect of selling and interacting with customers and learning how to balance budgets and taking in money and all of the components that go into it. It is a really amazing learning experience for them, and you really see them stretch and grow into young adults through the process.
I'm sitting here contrasting this with my experience in junior high school, and I don't remember doing any of this.
No,
this is a real different educational model.
It takes a lot of work on the part of teachers and students, because if you're not fully committed to it, it falls apart. And the kids take a lot of pride in it, and when you see them at public market or other venues, they're really enthusiastic about what they're doing because it's so real.
Exactly.
It's things that people do out in the real world, and that makes it meaningful.
To play slight devil's advocate here, I'm wondering how this meshes with the needs for subjects covered when a student goes into a traditional high school after an experience like this through Montessori's middle school.
Well, they learn a lot about, first of all, just responsibility and what it takes to be part of a team unit, and everybody has a different job to do, and they're all contributing. They're reading the recipes, obviously. They're figuring out a lot of, it's amazing how much practice they need in measurement and getting it right and figuring out what went wrong if they're following the recipe and the recipe doesn't work. We've had that happen. But one day it will work and another day it doesn't work. So obviously there's been a bit of a problem in measurement, or they're distracted and don't accurately measure what they've put in, or miss perhaps a cup of a one of the products.
Teach us some great science skills in creating hypotheses about why things didn't work out.
Yeah, exactly. And just the money aspect of it. And I think a big part of growing into a high school student is learning how to be a responsible citizen. And that's it's nothing beats real work experience to help students take ownership of their education and take pride in the work they've done and see that they've got a product right there in front of them. It's so tangible that they really rise to the occasion when they see that. And I think that can carry them a long way in high school.
How do students come into the Montessori program?
They come in, we do have a lottery, but we, at the middle school level, it's fairly open. So most students come because they've been through friends or they've come up through the program, and that's certainly ideal because they are already well acclimated to the Montessori program and to some of the tenets of Montessori. But we have about half our students are new to Montessori when they come into our program. And we have 7th and 8th grade and take both grade levels. That certainly mostly encourage, especially encourage 7th graders to apply, or 6th graders moving into 7th grade, because that's ideal. You have 2 years in the program and time to experience all the different opportunities that we have to offer.
Right. Montessori is an optional program in our district. It's part of the public school system, and it's all about finding the best fit for students and their learning needs and their families' needs for them. And so if a child or parent is interested in Montessori, it's best to do an observation in the classroom to really get to know what this program is all about, because there's lots of choice in Juneau and lots of great schools and programs, and it's all about finding what works for the kid.
How would a parent arrange for the chance to observe?
First thing to do is to contact the district office, the superintendent's office, and put in an application. Because it is part of a lottery process, but there are generally vacancies available. That's the first step, and then they will contact them and set up an observation time so that we can talk with the child and his or her family and see if this will be a good fit.
And then once that observation has taken place and the conversation has taken place, then do they still have to place in the lottery, or is it possible to move on in?
It depends on if there's open vacancies. And if there's open vacancies, their name will rise to the top and they will be offered a place. But if there aren't vacancies, then their name stays on the waiting list until something happens.
So who would they contact one more time?
So contact the superintendent's office at the Juneau School District, 523-1700.
Sarah Marino, principal at Yucatahiti, Debbie Chalmers, the instructor at the Montessori School, thank you so much for filling us in on this wonderful program.
Thanks,
and
Pat.
We'll hear more from you next week. Update on the forecast in the last second here. We will have snow tonight, but it's going to turn to rain tomorrow. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're at 104.3 on your FM dial. We run broadcast on these translators throughout the area on K276 AF in the Valley and Auk Bay. That's 103.1. Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. And K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.1.
Likely damage from...